First off, I'd like to really thank the staff at the University of Regina for even having me here today. It's very kind of them, and I need to thank all of you for coming here today, especially on this snowy situation that we have to listen to my talk today. By way of introduction, Rob said my name is Wayne Ryan. I was a member of the RCMP for 21 years. I joined at the age of 20 out of Saskatchewan, Saskatoon. And transferred to the Vancouver Island area when I first came out of training. During my career, I spent approximately 5 or 6 years in patrol duties. I did a little bit of drug duty, and most of my duty was on the major crime section at Surrey Detachment. Just by way again of background, I think I probably took part in approximately 80 homicide investigations and approximately 500 major crime investigations, and I was also the hostage negotiator at Surrey for almost all of those 10 years. While the book covers a wide range of topics, one of its primary focuses is a human aspect to policing and the emotional, personal, and professional challenges that police officers face. I felt it was important because it's a side of the story that the public rarely, if ever, really see or even contemplate. Now, I'm going to ask your guys' forgiveness a little bit. I've never given this talk before, so I am going to be doing a little bit more reading than I would normally like to do. But as I said, we will open the thing up for questions afterwards, so everybody knows. Now, one of the things I wanted to know off the bat is, do we have any, I know we have some, current serving police officers in the room? Show of hands. Great. Anybody contemplating a career in the RCMP or in law enforcement? Okay, great. Now, as the guys who are already police officers know, and what you aspiring officers will find out, is that there are really a tremendous amount of good news stories in policing. You meet some tremendous people. You meet some really kind-hearted people. You deal with a lot of uplifting stories. And so I would never discourage anybody from becoming a police officer, including my own kids. This book, however, is not about that part of it. I mean, I could have written another book twice as thick as this about those experiences and the fun you have and the laughter that you get out of the job. But this is a little bit on the heavier dutier side. And like I said, it tries to explain the emotional and personal challenges that officers face, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. So, what am I going to talk about today? Well, I'm going to discuss just who it is that we hire as police officers. Where do they come from? What are their characteristics? I'm going to talk about the public's perceptions and expectations of police officers and how they affect the public-police relationship. And we'll discuss some of the emotional and personal challenges that police officers face. We're going to talk a little bit including the use of force and how it's perceived versus the reality. In my book, I ask the following question. Is it possible that no human being is really and truly equipped to handle all of the things that a police officer must see, do, and feel on a regular basis throughout their career? So what do I mean by that question? Well, you don't have to look very hard or very far to find incidents of individual police failures, misconduct, excessive force, criminal behavior. We know that police officers suffer higher incidents of depression, anxiety, suicide, alcoholism, and divorce. How is it that in spite of extensive screening and testing, some of these men and women, our best and brightest, will fail? While there's been surprisingly little research done in this field, perhaps we can draw some conclusions from some of the research that has been done. Law enforcement is the most stressful occupation in North America, even surpassing the formidable stress of air traffic controllers. Hans Selye, world's foremost workplace stress researcher. Law enforcement is the most psychologically dangerous job in the world. Dr. Hans Toke, world-renowned expert and author of Stress in Policing. A recently published study called Changing Personality Patterns of Police Officers followed 25 newly recruited officers over a four-year period of time. Standard personality tests were used. Recruits were studied just after the completion of training with scores all within the normal range. When tested again after 2 years, scores showed significant changes with increased somatic symptoms, anxiety, stress, and alcohol vulnerability. At the four-year mark, only 11 officers remained. Almost all of them showed scores well within the critical range. So can it be as simple as that we're hiring the wrong people? Perhaps in some individual and isolated cases. But given that this problem exists literally across North America, from Los Angeles to New York and from Vancouver Island to Halifax, I think it might be more realistic to actually look at police work. What do we ask and expect of these young men and women? So let's talk a little bit about police recruits. Who are they? Where do they come from? And what do we as a society expect from them? Well, first and foremost, and with all respect to RoboCop fans, we hire from the human race. Police recruits are a cross-section of the society and the age group, culture, and gender from which they are selected, and they will have all of the individual strengths and weaknesses, values, attitudes, and work ethics common to their peers. They will have individual personalities, skills, abilities, biases, perceptions, and beliefs. That's the reality. But what does the public see and expect of our officers? Well, I think it would be reasonable that they expect honesty and integrity, courage, common sense, compassion, empathy, decisiveness. What else? Impartiality, fair, firm at times. That's, I think, a reasonably comprehensive list of what we might generally expect of our officers. And I think it's fairly consistent with what our officers would expect of their fellow officers. But what else do we expect of our officers? Well, I think we ask them to remain calm and controlled when everything is chaos and panic. We ask them to be fearless and selfless in the face of danger. We expect them to be tolerant in the face of physical, verbal, and emotional abuse, and to have a clear and accurate recall of events and details, regardless of what is happening. And I think, at least on a subconscious level, or to the extent that we even think about it at all, we expect them to remain unaffected by the constant exposure to cruelty, evil, pain, suffering, grief, and aggression. In short, I think that many of the public simply expect that every police officer should have all of the skills and knowledge required to handle anything that might occur. The real truth is that there is no innate God-given talent bestowed upon a police officer that gives them the power, skill, or ability to make the right decision or take the correct action in every situation, regardless of circumstance or experience. They remain human beings. But as we know, when expectations exceed performance, there's going to be disappointment. That, of course, leads to the question, are expectations too high or is performance too low? To examine this, I think we need to discuss where the public gets their perceptions about policing. What benchmark do they use to judge police officers? I was even surprised by this study, and supported by several other studies that show that in North America, 95% of the public will never have a significant interaction with a police officer. That means, and as the study showed, that most people, either consciously or subconsciously, develop most of their perceptions and expectations of police officers based on what they see on TV and the movies and television programs. Generally speaking, the study found that police officers are portrayed in one of three general manners. One is the hard-living, hard-drinking, driven, obsessed police officer, the Dirty Harry type, who will break any law or do anything he needs to do to get the bad guy. The second perception is the corrupt police officer, one who hides behind their badge and commits murder, extortion, theft, steals from drug addicts, that sort of thing. The third and perhaps the most damaging is the perfect police officer. You know, the incredibly, impossibly good-looking, well-dressed, physically fit, never miss a clue, arrest several suspects with a couple deft moves, shoot to wound, and they always solve the crime. And of course, it makes for terrific TV, but it leaves a really serious and erroneous perception and places an almost impossible expectation on real officers. If these studies are accurate, though, how does this really affect the relationship between the public and the police? Well, we've talked about how individual officers will have many varying degrees of strengths and weaknesses, personality, skills, and even experiences. So what happens when we send an officer whose real personality strength tends to be empathy and sensitivity to a call that requires decisive or commanding take charge type of action? Or when we assign a task that requires empathy and sensitivity to an officer whose real strengths tend to be strong, decisive, take charge? When we send an officer to the type of call or situation that they've never experienced before, what it really means is that that particular officer find themselves dealing with situations that require a different skill set, a different personality, or different experience than what they have. And they simply have to try to adapt to each call to the best of their abilities. When they fail, the public will often tend to be highly critical because the officers have also failed to live up to their expectations, however unrealistic that might be. So I ask you to consider this. Most adult humans will never experience a serious physical or verbal confrontation. In fact, psychologists know that we have an almost phobic level fear of that sort of confrontation. We'll go to great lengths to avoid it. Most of us will. The police officer, though, is like the fireman. As everybody's running out of the burning building, they're running in. And police officers are required to deal with confrontational situations frequently. They're asked to attend violent, emotional, volatile, and confrontational situations time after time. They may be called names, they may be threatened, they may have their families threatened. I think every serving officer in here has probably had their family threatened at some point in time. They may be spit on, assaulted, and have their safety or even their lives put at risk. What this really means is officers, individual officers, are tested time and time again for courage, tolerance, self-control, and quite frankly, most officers will pass that test on most occasions. But common sense alone should tell us that the simple law of averages, combined with human nature, makes it almost a certainty that once in a while things will go wrong. An officer may make the wrong decision, take the wrong action. Take, for example, an officer who goes to work distracted by a personal issue. Perhaps he's had a fight with a spouse. Maybe he's been up all night with a sick child. Perhaps he's got health worries or money worries or really any of the myriad of things that can affect any other human being out there. And this time, when the drunk spits on him or the suspect resists arrest, he doesn't show the tolerance that he should. He loses that self-control and he acts inappropriately or overreacts or uses excessive force. The public will judge him, and please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Officers, professionals always have to be accountable for their own actions. I totally believe that. But here's the funny thing. A lot of people will judge that officer, and most of the people doing the judging will never even have been tested one time, let alone having passed the test multiple times. It's like the 20-year-old soldier who fights bravely and courageously in 19 firefights. On the 19th, the 20th fight, something snaps in him, and he breaks and runs. That happens to be picked up by an embedded news cameraman, and it's broadcast to the world. And that 20-year-old officer will be judged not on the 19 firefights, but he'll be judged on the 20th by people who've never been in a single firefight. These are some of the challenges that the police-public relationship require us to address. Another thing that influences the public's perceptions and expectations is their concept of the effectiveness of officer training. In their belief that training covers all aspects of what a police officer must do and deal with, it then becomes somewhat easier to dismiss concerns for officers' emotional and psychological reactions by simply assuming that they're trained to handle these things. I can personally assure you that there's no training that will prepare you for picking up body parts at a crime scene or an accident scene. I guarantee you that there's no training that will teach you how to handle a severely abused child with a dozen cigarette burns on their body. How do you train someone to handle the overwhelming grief of parents who have lost a child to suicide or murder or accident? I wonder how you train somebody to handle having to take another human life. There simply is no training that will prepare you for those things. The public often significantly overestimates an officer's training and ability in self-defense and use of weapons. Believe that they should somehow be able to arrest multiple suspects using a few deft moves, shoot to wound, disarm a knife-wielding suspect with one blow, or subdue a struggling suspect quickly and simply with no injury to officer or suspect. The reality is much different. Most officers receive approximately 6 months of training. A fairly small portion of that is dedicated to self-defense and firearms training. I think if you went to any expert in self-defense, they would tell you it would take many, many years to develop the skills necessary to successfully arrest a suspect without any injury or danger to either party. Without taking my word from it, I'd like to defer to an expert. Dr. Bill Lewinsky is the executive director of Force Science Institute in the United States. He's a world-known and renowned expert on police use of force. He confirms in his studies that the public have often unrealistic perceptions about the abilities of the police, the effectiveness of self-defense tactics and weapons, and even the law of physics. He states that one of the fundamental truths about police and use of force is that whenever police use any level of force, there's a potential for unintended consequences, and that can't be overstated. I think probably the lowest level of force that a uniform officer can use is simply showing up at the scene in uniform. Imagine then that he shows up at the scene and before he even gets out of the car, the suspect sees him and decides to run across the street and he gets hit by a car. That can happen. So at any level of force, there can be unintended consequences that the officer is largely not in control of. He goes on to explain how it's virtually impossible for an officer to judge precisely the amount of force, especially in the midst of an adrenaline-fueled struggle. If a suspect is taken to the ground, they may fall awkwardly and break an arm. This would be more accidental than excessive force. A baton strike aimed at an arm or shoulder may miss and accidentally hit the head, not because the officer was careless or deliberate, but because the suspect was ducking and moving. The public may observe three or four officers subduing a suspect and feel that it somehow offends the sense of fair play. When in actual fact, excessive and overwhelming force often significantly reduces danger to or injury to suspect and officer. The same thing applies when officers use pepper spray or tasers. It's often misunderstood by the public and seen as excessive. The truth of the matter is this. In real life, a physical altercation between adults is vicious, violent, and ugly. There's nothing like what is portrayed on the movies, and there's no way to make it look like that. It's visceral. When Dr. Lewinsky discusses the use of deadly force, he explains why officers can't shoot to wound and points to the many studies which show stress and adrenaline significantly affect accuracy, and that in incidents of extreme stress, with both officer and suspect often in motion, it would be almost impossible to shoot at a specific area. And that officers are simply trained to shoot neither to wound or kill, but to stop the threat, and that it's most reliably done by aiming at the largest part of the target. He goes on to say how the public is often critical when officers shoot a suspect who is armed only with a knife or other handheld weapon. And that's because they don't fully comprehend the level of the threat. Studies have shown that a reasonably active adult can cover approximately 30 feet in the time it would take an officer to draw and fire one shot from his weapon. I can tell you this, that most officers know for a fact that it's very, very rare that a single shot would stop a suspect. I know on TV they're flung violently backwards and the threat's instantly over, and that's not the case in real life. So officers are faced with a dilemma. they shoot too soon, the public's going to say they executed that man or woman. If he waits too long, the suspect gets within the threat radius, and the public or the officers can be in danger. And I go into quite a bit more depth in the book, and I use several real-life scenarios to point out what I'm trying to say about that. In a discussion about use of force, Dr. Lewinsky also refers to the physiological changes that occur in a high stress or danger situation. And this is interesting. Most of you in the class would know what is fight or flight syndrome. And there's some interesting physiological changes that occur to the body. And the ones that most would affect a police officer are the changes that happen in the brain when the body's focused on an immediate threat. And the part of the brain that is responsible for logic and reason is partially shut down and taken over by the instinct-based portion of the brain. And these changes are largely involuntary. What this means is that perception narrows as much as, excluding as much as 70% of the surrounding area. Officers have reported not even hearing other shots or seeing other suspects if they're focused totally on that threat. This often, and in the book I discuss it, is combat stress syndrome. But what happens is that two things can result from this human instinct when the instinct portion of the brain takes over. There's the human instinct for self-preservation and the instinctual reaction to fear, which often comports as anger or a need to punish whatever or whoever caused the intense fear. These things in turn can result in officers escalating the use of force or even using excessive force when they're in physical danger, frightened, or involved in intense situations such as high-speed chases, high-risk arrests, or badly outnumbered such as in riots, large parties, bar fights, and similar incidents. I don't know if any of you have children, but we've all probably seen a child that makes a dash for a busy street and the parents grab them and give them a smack, and it's not because they're angry at the child, but it scared them so badly it's an instinctive reaction. And it's something that police officers have to learn to their best to control. But that's why you'll often see officers, how often when you see a video of an officer overreacting and using excessive force, is it after a high-speed chase or in a volatile arrest situation? If you're an officer and you're arresting somebody at 1:20 in the morning and you know that that bar empties out at 1:30, you don't have 15 minutes to talk to the guy, because once the crowd comes out of that bar, you are in danger of losing control of the situation. Lastly, Dr. Lewinsky provides some encouraging news when he tells us that several independent studies on North American policing have consistently shown force is only used in approximately 1% of all police-to-public contact, that virtually 100% of use of force occurs during arrests, and that after all of that, and there's a lot of people in here who are a lot smarter than me in math, that 0.44% of force used could be considered excessive. I couldn't find any studies relative to Canada, but that's what these massive studies in the States showed. The one study I could find, the BC Civil Liberties Union is very, very critical recently of police in British Columbia, because there were approximately 257 police in custody related deaths in a 15-year period of time. And you have to understand, and the officers here will, but those of you who are not may not understand this. Officer involved or in custody deaths include accidental deaths, suicides, overdoses with drug or alcohol, another prisoner killing another prisoner, police car accident, whether it's the officer's fault or not, and of course, deaths as a result of use of force. They were very, very critical about that. I tried to put it in perspective in my book, and I said, you'll never hear me excuse police misconduct, but it's interesting to put it into perspective. And I'm not picking on the medical community, but they're so great at providing stats that it was hard not to use them. Every year in Canada, according to their own statistics, between 9,000 and 24,000 Canadians die as a direct result of human error. To further narrow that down, there was a study of 500 anesthesia-related deaths. And a study found that 80% of those were as a result of preventable human error. I can tell you this, if there were 500 Canadians killed by police one year, there'd be riots in the street. And so it posed the question, you take a 24-year-old officer, provide them with 6 months training, and then hold them to a higher level of accountability than you might a doctor with 7 years of training. And it makes you wonder why that happens. But on the other hand, we are sort of the last line. And if we're like the goalie, if they get by us, it's all over. So I understand the public's perceptions, but it's something that we have to learn to deal with. That leads us to some of the emotional challenges. So that puts the use of force into some context. And yes, the public does ask and expect much of our officers. And frankly, most of the time those expectations are met. But there's also a lot of misunderstanding and unrealistic expectations. And when individual officers fail, use poor judgment, unnecessary force, or when they show fear, emotion, anger, impatience, or intolerance, or simply act unprofessionally, the public is disappointed or angry because the behavior offends the public's perception of how they want their police officers to be. I wonder if there are times when we feel that an officer has failed, when all they've really done is be human. That leads us to some of the emotional challenges that almost every police officer has to deal with. I believe that the public often underestimates the emotional challenges, and I'd like to give you just one example. You might attend a fatal motor vehicle accident and the victim's a beautiful young 17-year-old girl and her body is mangled almost beyond recognition. You have to learn to deal with that, but here's the problem. An hour later, it may be your unhappy duty to visit her parents and spend an hour watching the overwhelming grief and heartbreak that you can't do anything about. Then add to that, that an hour later, you're called to arrest an impaired driver. You know that the young girl's been killed by an impaired driver. You arrest this impaired driver, and he's resistant, or he's mouthy, or he calls you a bunch of names. And all you want to do is drag him by the scruff of the neck back to that accident scene and make him see what you just had to see. You want to drag him to those parents and make him see the grief and the heartbreak that you've just seen. But you can't do that. You have to learn as an officer to take those emotions and bury them somewhere, wherever that individual officer finds to bury them, and you have to find a way to deal professionally with that impaired driver, regardless of your personal feelings. The fact that officers learn to hide those feelings and emotions is often mistaken for a lack of feeling, callousness, or that they're seemingly unaffected by human pain and suffering. I assure you that they are affected, and officers can pay a high personal price for this. I wonder how you deal all day with a badly abused child, and then you go home and your own child is complaining that their homework is missing, or perhaps your spouse has had an argument with a coworker. You know intellectually that that's important to that child or to your spouse, and it is. But how do you make the emotional shift from dealing with that seriously abused child to the relatively minor complaints of your family and remain connected with your family? Again, every officer has to find a way to do that. Because of the things that officers regularly deal with, they may be inclined to treat many of life's normal problems as trivial or unimportant. And this can be hurtful to family and friends. They may use cynicism to guard against disappointment and risk the inability to trust. They may become desensitized at the risk of becoming insensitive. And they may learn to hide their fear and pain at the risk of hiding all of their emotions. Can any human being remain the same untouched and unaffected by a career so filled with death, pain, and suffering. Like the mother who sends her boy to war and is shocked at the man who returns, so it may well be with police officers. Can any human being face all of these challenges day after day, month after month, and get it right every time? I couldn't. Herein lies the challenge. There is simply no way to avoid the fact that every police department will have its share of personnel and operational problems, its public relations disasters, and its internal disputes. They are inevitable. It's how those police departments and the public respond to those issues that will define the relationship between the two. We must realize that in spite of best efforts, mistakes will be made, and that some of those mistakes will have a high cost. We must find a way not to accept, but to understand and forgive those mistakes. And most importantly, we have to remain vigilant against focusing solely on the relatively few failures and ignoring the many successes, or from allowing the bad conduct of a few to taint the exceptional work of many. At this point, I'd like to tell you a story. I know it's true because it's my story. I think in many regards it will bring into focus what I've just been talking about. I was raised during the 50s and 60s in rural Saskatchewan, and life was pretty simple. I grew up on a farm and quickly learned about responsibilities. I was raised to learn the difference between right and wrong. In my world, things were pretty black and white, and there wasn't much gray. In 1975, after graduation from the University of Saskatchewan, I joined the RCMP, and upon graduation was sent to Vancouver Island. I arrived with all the confidence of youth, convinced that I had a firm grasp of what was right and wrong, that things were still either black and white, and yes, I was much like a Boy Scout, spit-shined and ready to change the world. I had yet to discover that it would be the world that changed me. I was 21 years old when I had the first person die in my arms. Two young guys my age, driving too fast and drinking. Pickup truck flipped end over end. Passenger was thrown halfway out the back when the pickup truck landed on its roof, crushing and almost cutting him in half. While we waited for the jaws of life, I held him, told him he'd be okay, but of course he wasn't. Not much later, I attended a motor vehicle accident. The victim was a young 17-year-old girl. Terrible scene. I was then my duty to notify her parents, and I will never forget the look on their faces when they opened up that door and saw me standing there. I will never forget the feeling of complete inadequacy as a 21-year-old wondering, how do I deal with this? For the first time since I was a child, I went home and cried. And I actually asked myself if I was really cut out to be a police officer. How in the name of God do these officers deal with this kind of thing time after time and have it seemingly unaffect them when it was damn near killing me? But as time went on, it did get easier. I, like most officers, began to build the shield and the protective wall that lets you handle those things and survive. I built little compartments in my mind that I would deal with the situation and tuck away and move on. There were more bodies, there were suicides, there were more parents notified, but it did get easier and it became a little bit more commonplace. I started to learn that there was a little bit of gray. I found that certain criminals I actually liked and respected better than some of the so-called pillars of the community. Hard to imagine, but there's the gray for you. I started seeing children that were abused, family fights and domestic violence that would make you weep. Went to Prince Rupert and had my first real experience with First Nations policing. I saw firsthand the results of abject poverty, alcohol abuse, and the loss of hope. Surprisingly, or perhaps not surprisingly, I should say, maybe two doors down from that same house, you would meet some of the most kind, giving, and selfless people that you would ever meet. One of those people was my friend Max. Max is a native special constable. He had an incredible job. He was born and raised in Prince Rupert. His family, his friends were all there. And he had to police that community. He was an amazing guy. Max would come over with fresh sockeye salmon, and we'd have a few of the guys over and have a beer. One night, I was a senior constable in charge of the watch. We got called to a house. Loud commotion and fighting going on. When I walked in there, there was Max and his brother, Fred, drinking, fighting. I was able to get Fred calmed down. But for some reason, Max wouldn't shut up. He kept yapping and yipping and aggravating the situation. Freddie Lincoln was one of the toughest men I've ever met in my life. And I knew that if he got angry, neither Max or I working together would stop him. So as a last resort, I arrested my friend Max. I put him in cells. And then I had a dilemma. Because the right thing to do, the policy thing to do, was to report Max to headquarters, and headquarters probably would have fired him. The dilemma was this. Max was one of the very few, maybe the only, real positive role model that so many of those young First Nations men and boys had. So I added another big chunk of gray between the black and white. I released Max before the day shift came on. As I drove him home, I couldn't help but notice the look of shame on his face. We never talked about it again. But our friendship was never really the same again. It wasn't long after that that I lost another friend. This one, a lot more tragic. A friend of mine was attempting to arrest an armed and dangerous suspect, and he was shot in the head and killed. It brought us face to face with our own mortality, and it was a pretty sad day. It wasn't all that much longer. I was working playing Coes, and I came across one of our local sex trade workers, and she was just a kid, just a kid. She'd been beaten up, I could see that. She wouldn't, of course, tell me who had done it. She had some small amount of drugs on her. And for some reason, I decided to take some pity on her. So I seized the drugs as a no-case exhibit, and I gave her a ride home. Unbelievably, several months later, that small act of kindness and the absolutely incredible courage of that sex trade worker, a person who I would certainly never have expected it from, converged and combined, and it saved my life. So I go, imagine the world I live in where a drug-addicted sex trade worker would save my life. Better add some more gray. Again, as I said, things were starting to pile up, and by this time I felt that I had reasonably good control over my emotions. I would deal with these things, and I was had around 10 years service, I guess, when I transferred to Surrey. And as I said, I felt I was a pretty seasoned police officer by then. I really thought that I'd sort of seen it all and done it all. And very, very shortly after arriving at Surrey, I transferred on to the major crime section. I soon discovered that the previous 10 years had literally been kindergarten compared to what I was about to see. I saw young girls as young as 3 and 4 so violently sexually assaulted that they'll never have children. I saw children tortured by their own parents with dozens of cigarette burns on their body. Saw a father kill his entire family to spare them the shame of learning that he'd lost his job. a doctor who hired a hitman to kill a beautiful 22-year-old girl because she'd had the audacity to report him for sexual abuse. I recall the day as a hostage negotiator that I thought I'd been successful when I got the first of two young girls out of the house unharmed. I recall telling the incident commander I had it under control. And I recall the helpless feeling when I heard the shot that proved I was wrong. And I'll never forget that father's grief. I saw suicides and murders that had experienced firefighters and paramedics throwing up outside. I dealt with two drug dealers who killed a sex trade worker, again, just a kid. And it was too much work to bury her body, so they used a chainsaw to cut her up into about a dozen pieces, loaded her up in garbage bags, buried her, didn't have to dig as big a hole. It was my job to be there when those remains were recovered. It was my job to be at the autopsy and help the pathologist put the body together like a jigsaw puzzle. As time went by, I built bigger and better shields, more compartments. The lines between right and wrong were often blurred. We dealt with informants that were worse than the people that they were informing on. Like Monopoly, we traded this crime for that crime. The moral compass started to get a little hazy. The lines between what's right and wrong were sometimes confusing. The simple fact is that I had become rather a clinician in my investigations of homicides. I no longer viewed the body as a human being with family and loved ones and friends. They were simply evidence, something to be photographed and tagged and swabbed and measured. It was easier to deal with that way. I could simply process the scene and move on to the next. My shields were so firmly in place that I was convinced I was firmly in control of everything. I say, so I thought. Excuse me, I got a little my nose here. One day my partner and I caught a homicide call, drove down the street, and my clinician brain was already ticking off the little check marks in my mind, the things I'd have to do. So we drove down the street, I noticed it was a really quiet little residential street. All the homes were really nicely cared for, the yards were beautiful. Pulled up to the house, we walked inside, and I noticed several things. I noticed the house itself was extremely neat and tidy. I noticed that the house was decorated with pink ribbons and balloons for a six-year-old girl's birthday party. I noticed there was a vacuum cleaner standing in the kitchen. And on the floor beside the vacuum cleaner, in a large pool of blood, was a young woman who'd been stabbed multiple times. As we started going through the house, I noticed a few blood spots on the stairs leading to the second level. We started climbing the stairs. I noticed that the blood trail started to get a little heavier. At the top of the stairs, the blood trail led directly to a closed bedroom door. I did not want to open that door. And I prayed to God that I would not find what I knew I would. But of course, God had abandoned me a long time ago, or so I thought. And I did open that door, and something inside of me broke. There was a little six-year-old girl lying on her back in a party dress, her eyes wide open, staring at the ceiling. She'd been stabbed so viciously in the chest that the imprint of the knife handle was still buried in her breastbone. I had to leave and go outside and regain my composure. And I remember stupidly thinking, Ryan, you're a homicide cop. This is what you do. Get it together, man. So I did go back inside and I did my job, but I was almost like in a fugue state. I know it was almost like I was watching my body perform outside of it. It was almost a surreal feeling. We went through the checklist, and sure enough, we discovered that this deceased woman had recently befriended a fellow who had been out on parole. We found that she was kind of like that. She was the kind that would bring in a wounded pet or animal. She obviously wounded people. We were able to contact one of his known associates and received information that this fellow's intention was to steal a car in the Surrey area, drive over to Coquitlam, do a drug rip off, kill the drug dealer, and escape with the money. We put out an APB on the vehicle and the suspect. It wasn't very long after that that the Coquitlam RCMP located the vehicle. It led them on a high-speed pursuit, and the driver fired several shots at the pursuing officers. They were able to stop him and arrest him, and nobody got hurt or injured. And it was my job to go to that scene and arrest the suspect. As we drove to that scene, I felt myself getting angrier and angrier. Here's the really amazing thing. I was mad at the Coquitlam officers because they hadn't killed that man when they had an opportunity. That was the first sign that I should have recused myself from that situation. But I didn't. We arrested the suspect, put him in the car, and there wasn't a word said on the way back. He sat in the back and he had a little smirk on his face the whole time. We got him into the cells, lodged him in, went upstairs and did the debriefing. And a few minutes later, we had him moved to a secure interview room with video and audio. We went downstairs, checked our firearms into the lockers, as was policy, and went into the interview room. I'd by this time interviewed, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of suspects. I was sort of the primary interviewer on the homicide team. I had interviewed a lot of homicide suspects. I really, again, felt that I was the master of my domain there. And so I started the interview, and I tried to develop a little bit of a rapport with him, and he sat there with a smirk on his face. So then I started to try and use a little bit of logic and point to some of the evidence we had. Nothing. Sat there with a smirk on his face. Then I thought I would see if there's even a spark of conscience in this fellow. And I pointed out how this woman had befriended him when nobody else would, and how the little girl never hurt a soul in her life. He made his one and only comment to me. He yawned and he said, "When do they serve food in this place?" Well, I felt the blood literally drain out of my face. My partner later said I turned as white as a sheet of paper. My hands started to shake on the table. My whole body started to shake. And I felt a rage come over me that I had never in my life felt before. And it was a killing rage. I didn't want to just hurt this guy. I wanted to kill this guy. I remember standing up and using every single ounce of self-control and discipline that I developed over an entire career as a police officer. And I turned around and I walked out of that interview room. I came this close to being that officer that would be caught on a videotape beating up a handcuffed prisoner. That close. I walked out of that cell block, I walked past my gun, I walked out the room, I walked outside, and I tried to compose myself. The rage I felt has been so overwhelming it actually shocked me back into reality. And I realized one thing. I realized that I could never, ever allow myself to be alone anywhere with him again. I never had contact with him again after that. I can tell you that I was really never the same officer again after that. There were still more murders and there was lots of more calls, and I did it, and I did my job. But my heart had gone out of it. I was promoted to sergeant, and even that didn't seem to fill the gap, and I felt that my career-wise, I'd kind of come to the end of the road, and I retired. I realized that I had to do two things. I had to figure out a way to to reconnect with God, because, of course, he hadn't abandoned me. I'd abandoned him a long time ago. I also discovered that I needed to go back and see if I could find that Boy Scout again. I did eventually reconnect with God, and I'm happy to report that I did find that Boy Scout. He was pretty tattered and beaten up, but I was able to dust him off and clean him up, and he actually turned out pretty good. In fact, he's standing here before you today. So, in conclusion, I said in my book that a mind stretch to accept new ideas today may very well create new ideas tomorrow. I hope that today I've been able to stretch your minds a little bit. And thank you for listening. And if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, or at least try. I should tell you this, there's no question off the boards as far as I'm concerned, but I have been retired for several years. I probably am not the most up-to-date on current policies and procedures, so please accept my apologies if I can't answer those questions. And while I'm prepared to comment on specific incidents, if you have any, again, please understand that, you know, if I wasn't there, I can't comment specifically about that sort of thing. But otherwise, no comment out of question, or no question out of order. Nothing?
Well, probably 1,000 questions, but it's just kind of, we're all kind of sitting going, wow.
Well, that's why I said at the beginning, you know, this was designed to be kind of emotional and impactful. That's not police work in its entirety. It's a part of it. It's a part of it, and it's a part that I think the public doesn't see very often. And that's what the purpose of my book was. It was to say, we're not perfect. We're going to screw up. We do our best, but in spite of that, and we're going to have officers that fail. We're going to have them fail for lots of reasons. Some that are just not suited for the job. Some the job changes them so dramatically that they're not the same person they were when they joined. Again, none of that excuses bad behavior. I really am not trying to excuse bad behavior. I'm trying to explain it. And again, so that's why I say, if there are questions, now that was a perfect time to answer them. I'd be happy to do that.
Mm-hmm. I have a question, but it's rather personal, so you don't have to answer if you don't have to.
Yeah? You know, I didn't. But, you know, the world was a little different in those days. What happened in those days, and it may still happen in certain departments, but we were a very close group. And we quite often, we might work till midnight on a file, and then we'd go and have a beer and blow off steam, and we'd talk to each other, right? And I don't know if that worked, but I still get together with a lot of my old partners from major crime, and all of us are pretty well-adjusted people. None of us are... you know, now, I can tell you, I've never walked into a room decorated with balloons and ribbons again in my life without having that memory come back to me. But it's not a debilitating thing, you know. But so the answer is no, I never did. But I think we kind of were our own psychologists to some degree. You get together and have a beer, and that helped a lot, I think. But it's a great question.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
What is that significant encounter?
Well, he doesn't go into that on his study, but I would presume it's anything more than maybe a traffic ticket or, you know, so that, you know, if you were involved in something where the police were actually kind of significantly involved in that incident. I that's how I kind of took it, because, I mean, lots of us get tickets, myself included. I know nobody asked this, but I'll just tell you. This fellow who killed this little girl, he was actually sentenced to life in prison, and he actually a few years later stabbed a prison guard, didn't kill him, but seriously injured him. And then a few years after that, did probably the only decent thing he's ever done in his life and killed himself in prison. I have an alibi for that day. Yeah, that was an interesting case. We had a really serious homicide up in Prince Rupert. And again, it was a sex trade worker that had been murdered. And we had an interesting situation in Rupert. We had about 4,000 iron workers living in a temporary camp just outside of town. Prince Rupert was the main harbor for all the entire northern fishing fleet, the Canadian Navy, the US Navy, and all the logging and fishing in the area. So the town of Rupert would literally double on weekends. And she was, not only was she a sex trade worker, but she was a drug dealer. So she had a lot of contact with a lot of different criminals. And her very best friend was a fellow who was living with the same sex trade worker that I had dealt with. I was approaching him because he was the victim's friend, and we often needed to know, okay, she was seen with such and such and so and so and such and such a day. Do you know that guy, or you know what her movements were? So we were using him as an asset. And like I said, we did a deal with him. Look, I don't care about your drug deal, and that's not what I'm here. I'm here to try and solve a murder. So we had this little deal between us, that kind of a no-ask, no-tell thing about what he was doing drug-wise. Well, I would go back and forth to that house. I probably went back and forth to that house 5-6 different times to ask him questions about what her movements had been, the victim's movements had been. And I noticed that his behavior was starting to deteriorate. But you know, unlike the CSI guy, I just didn't clue in. As it turned out, he actually was the one who had murdered the victim. It was, even though she was his best friend, he'd gone over to get drugs, she wouldn't give it to him, and he lost control and he murdered her. I didn't know that, though. So I would go to his house time and time again. The last time I went to his house, I remember it took a long time for him to get to the door. I figured, probably arrived and he had some dope showing and he was hiding it. And he came to the door and he was totally strung out. And I thought, yeah, for sure he's got dope in the house, but I honored our agreement and I just asked him a couple of quick questions and I left. 2 days later, our office got a call from the sex trade worker he was living with. And she was in Vancouver, and she said she wanted to talk to the police. I was the only officer she talked to, and she had some information about the murder. So I flew to Vancouver and interviewed her, and she told me that within a few hours of my first visit, he told her that he'd actually killed the sex trade worker. But they were living together, and she was scared of him, and he kind of begged her not to say, so she didn't say anything. And I'd never really talked to her again because she didn't know the victim that well. So she said what happened on the last day, he was absolutely convinced that I was playing with him and that I was going to arrest him. So the last time I visited, he went into his bedroom and he came out with a 12-gauge shotgun. And he told her he was going to kill me and then they were going to flee the area. Of course, I'm standing outside the door. I don't have a clue that this is going on. And this woman, she was scared out of her wits at her own boyfriend. I mean, she was scared of this guy. She literally put herself between the door and him and would not let him cross. And she finally was able to calm him down and she told him what I'd done, you know, the favor I'd done, and that no, that was not to kill me, that what they'd do is after I left, they would pack up and take off. So when I did leave, she was so scared of this guy that she waited till he fell asleep, took off to Vancouver, and then when she was safe, she called us. So literally, that's what happened. I probably would be in a box somewhere if she hadn't done that. So that's why I say, strange world where the people you're arresting are saving your life, but it happens. Truth is stranger than fiction. You can't make that stuff up. Anything else? Geez, usually people ask me about Drzanski. If I was in Vancouver, that's all the questions would be.